once again, listeners, and a happy new year. It's 2014, but we plan to party like it's 1999, because all the cool kids know it's still the hip year. I, as always, am Craig, and with me, as always, Scott Burris.
Delighted to meet you.
And Drew Tavendale.
Greetings.
He's also delighted to meet you. He's just a little bit more reserved. We've got a fair few films to talk about tonight, so without further ado, let us crack on.
Just a quick heads up that at some point during this podcast, my mic has a complete fit and therefore I have to switch to the internal microphone built into my computer of choice. So apologies for that, but otherwise, take it.
Scott, we are all, I wouldn't say closet fans of the Statham. I think we are just fond of the Statham. He has a new film out called Homefront. Would you care to indulge in a little bit of exposition?
Yes, we are out of the Jason Statham closet and are parading up and down happily.
He's taken us all to look at photographs.
And we all know what they're of.
We all know what those photographs contain. Sorry, Scott, I digress.
So his latest film, which was screenwritten by Sylvester Stallone, no less, he's the Stath, take up the mantle of Phil Broker. We are initially introduced to him as a undercover DEA agent infiltrating a biker gang with perhaps his most ridiculous hairstyle. Yeah,
it's quite the mullet.
It is essentially worth seeing the film purely for that haircut alone.
Real men wear mullets, Scott. Yeah.
Absolutely preposterous. When his investigation comes to an end, it's a little bit more messy than he would like, and he decides that it's best to leave the exciting life of an undercover DEA agent and take a small place down in the south of America and raise his daughter in relative peace and quiet. Unfortunately, the area he's chose to move into turns out to be a bit of a hotbed of meth, crystal meth
production. Don't pretend you don't know what it is.
Because it's so hot right now. Everyone's into the old crystal meth. While he's just looking to raise his daughter into peace and quiet, he runs afoul of some of the locals, which eventually brings him into the eyesight of the local crystal meth production kingpin, played by James Franco, with the ridiculous name of Morgan Gator Bodine. And the two begin a somewhat of an antagonistic relationship, although in a very convenient bit of plotting, Bodine becomes aware that Phil Broker has this history with another gang, the biker gang, who he wants to have distribute his crystal meth. So, well, the two align forces against Jason, who essentially then has to take down both Franco's operation and the remnants of the biker gang in the somewhat ridiculous action finale. Now, as an action film, it is kind of what you'd expect from Jason Statham these days. It is very competent in most of the things that it does without ever being particularly remarkable. It has decent performances from pretty much in it. It has a cast which is arguably quite a bit better than the source material deserves, which does help things out quite a bit. You've got Winona Ryder, Kate Bosworth, as well as Franco and Statham. It's generally handled quite well dramatically and arguably quite a bit better than the script actually deserves. However, the relationship between Statham and his daughter is quite well handled. It seems believable and it's gives enough impetus for the chaos that unfolds towards the end. Plot-wise, it is amazingly convenient. There's a few things that happen in there just that is almost entirely inexplicable. Thankfully, it has the good grace not to dwell on them as to how some of these completely disparate events get tied together. I guess I can let that slide because for the most part, it's quite enjoyable. As an action drama piece goes, it is kind of comfortably somewhat better than mediocre. It is halfway decent. It is an enjoyable little watch for the 90 minutes or so that it stays with you. It doesn't outstay its welcome. It's reasonably well paced. The action's quite well handled. The dramatic stuff's adequate. There's a few lighter moments as well. It gives Jason a few moments to do his trademark cooling the gangisms. It's fine. It's a perfectly fine film, but it's not really something that you can justify going to any great lengths to actually go and see. It's not bad. But I can't say much more about it than that.
Well, if you don't want to say any more about it than that, Scott,
no, I
so
can't.
Be it.
I just can't.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. In that case, we'll move on. Drew, did you indulge in some Homefront?
I did. I was like a bit of the Stath, as you know.
Sounds like a medical condition, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Probably get a cream for that. It's something I had a bit of a troubled birth. It was actually written about 10 years ago by Stallone for himself to star in, and you apparently decided that it wasn't all that great, got passed from pillar to post. Finally taken up here with Statham, the lead role, and directed by the director of Runaway Jury. But it's fortunately much better than that would suggest. As Scott said, it's above mediocre. It's not going to blow you away. It's perhaps not quite as good as Parker from earlier in the year, although there are similarities in tone and Statham's performance, but it's never going to convert anyone to the cult of the Stath, but I think if you like him, then you're going to enjoy this.
The cult of this, just making it sound slightly more sinister than perhaps it really is.
You don't know the truth yet, Craig.
The terrible, terrible truth.
Yeah, it's fine. It's enjoyable enough. If I like Jason Statham, some decent action sequences. Perhaps brings to mind some things like Walking Tall or somebody sort of meeting out punishment to bad guys in a small town. It's okay. It's enjoyable enough to damn it with faint praise if ever there was a way to do that.
Fair dues. Of course, my question is, does Statham take anyone to look at nude photographs in this film?
Sadly, no.
Then it's at least below par of one other Statham film that we've seen this year. So that's the only opinion I have of it. Drew, time was when every new Disney animation used to be met with some fanfare, but many would say those days are over. However, Frozen, their latest offering, seems to have been garnering some praise. What say you?
Yes, I'll tell a little bit about it first before going to my opinion. This would be, as you say, the latest Disney film. It sees Elsa, heir to the throne of the Kingdom of Arendelle, cursed with an affliction. She can manipulate snow and ice, but can't always control it, which leads to some King Midas-like moments of converting stuff she touches to ice that she doesn't want to. While playing as children, Elsa accidentally harms her younger sister Anna with her wintry powers and locks herself away for years, lest she do more lasting damage. When she comes of age to take the throne, thousands of people attend a coronation, at which she inadvertently reveals her powers. She then flees the kingdom to cries of the burn the witch variety, and leaves the kingdom in the grip of a brutal winter, and it's up to her sister Anna to seek Elsa out and restore summer to Arendelle. Frozen follows the tried and trusted Disney playbook pretty closely. Princess in peril, muscular male love interest, animal friends, comedy sidekick, musical numbers, and really, it's all pretty underwhelming. Part of the problem is certainly the music. Too much information is contained in the lyrics, and if it's not your type of music, and for me, apart from the big central number, which to my surprise I enjoyed, it isn't, then the film is already operating at a deficit. It also suffers from being predictable, though it's the journey rather than the destination that matters, I guess. There are certainly some funny moments, and rather in spite of myself, because I'm a weary, cynical bastard, the sidekick Olaf the Snowman is actually quite entertaining, which really surprised me. And Frozen certainly looks good. The relationship between the sisters is underexplored but interesting, and it pulls an unexpected, very unfairy tale-like twist with one of the characters, but really, it's still not enough. Elsa's struggle to control her powers isn't as significant as it should be, as she's not really seen for much of the film, something not helped by the endless biting winter the kingdom is suffering from lasting more or less a day. Real hardships there. Now, as you alluded to, Craig, Frozen had generated quite a buzz, and that, coupled with the fact the artwork looked appealing, meant that I certainly went into the film reasonably hopeful this would join the small handful of Disney films I've ever liked. Alas, that was not to be. The biggest reason for this is that it's a pretty formulaic Disney film with princesses. I don't think it's any coincidence that of the few Disney films I have any time for, none of them have a princess as the main character. The female leads, Anna and Elsa, are certainly a bit of a step up from traditional Disney princesses, and they're certain to be described as feisty and possibly empowered or other such utter nonsense in some corners. And like Rapunzel in 2010's Tangled, they're more forthright and arse-kicky than Disney princesses of yesteryear. But being different from Disney princesses of yesteryear means they just strike me as being not helpless and possibly just regular women. And in the end, there's still a relationship with the Prince Charming, which rather undermines it all. So in the end, pretty disappointing, and probably only one for big Disney fans.
Well, I thought it was fine.
Did you think it was fine, Scott?
Yeah.
Excellent. Expound.
No.
Okay.
Well, it's formulaic, but it's applying the formula, I think, much better than Disney has done in a good long while, which, again, we're back into the faint praise thing, because Disney hasn't been very good for a long time, with the obvious exception of the Pixar stuff. This isn't doing anything outlandishly new, but it looks pretty. The story's told well enough. The characters are all right. My real complaint is it's got a bit too much singing in it for my liking, in the main, because some of the lyrics would actually make quite funny lines if they weren't being sung, which kind of ruins the whole delivery of them. Other than that, I thought it was okay. I can't quite agree with the old kind of fairly overboard praise that it's got. I think this has been hailed as a stunning return to form for Disney and that kind of stuff, and it's not. It's a bit better than average, but a bit better than average is much, much better than Disney as a studio have been doing of late. So in that respect, I think it does deserve at least some credit. I thought it was perfectly fine. It's formulaic stuff, but I think it does it quite well. Decent voice talent throughout it, which kind of helps, I guess. Reasonably funny lines. Say, looks very pretty. Yeah, all the sort of inter-character relationships are probably a bit more traditional than you would perhaps be wanting, I guess, in this day and age. However, it's perfectly fine. Certainly enjoyable enough for what I think their target audience is, and it's decent, and it's a bit better than average. You know, not bad, not bad.
Could be worse.
Could be.
I award it 6.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Aye. Not bad.
It's all right, like. yeah. The Hobbit Part 2, The Desolation of Smaug. How many frames a second did we see it in? Who knows? Who cares? Scott, do you care?
I do care a bit, but only because you can't see it in the high frame rate version in Falkirk, as far as I'm aware. And so we had to settle for the boring old standard frame rate, like every other film. Ooh, how dull. This, of course, is the third of the slender volume The Hobbit, which is probably about as concise a summation of the problems with the film as I came up with. The Desolation of Smaug at least takes you to the point where you actually see a dragon, so that's a good thing. For those who have joined us late, Bilbo, played by Martin Freeman, is leading his merry band of hobbits throughout the forests, through the Mirkwood and the elves, taking us all the way up to the lake town and the Lonely Mountain itself. So it's doing a fair bit more interesting things than perhaps the first one did. However, it's still suffering from a lot of the same flaws. I feel there's little point going into any of the detail of it. You've probably already either seen the first one and can either fill it in for yourself, or you've seen the first one and you no longer care what's happening in this one. So let's probably just skip over most of the gory details. But basically, the problems with The Desolation of Smaug are still the same problems as you had with the first installment. The things that have been added in to bulk out this, as we say, slender child's volume into three full-length movies just simply isn't strong enough. There's more additional sort of orc lieutenants for the band to go up against, then they still look a bit crap and have no character, which is a bit unfortunate, and it's still overly reliant on some fairly crassly put in action scenes that in some cases diminish what's actually happened to the characterization of some of the other folks. There's a lot of things that you can pick niggles at, but I think they're really going to be the same niggles as we would have been picking with the first film. So I don't see there's a lot of point in going over those again. That said, I did enjoy this at least somewhat more than the first film, which I think I'm probably still the most steadfast defender of in this podcast. I thought it was okay. I think this one is a little bit better than okay. I think it does its action scenes somewhat better, and they're a little bit less shoehorned in. There's a couple of pretty funny sequences. The problem I've come to realise with this adaptation of The Hobbit is actually less the things that have been added in by Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh and so on, rather than their absolute quality or their necessity the plot. The problem comes from the kind of tone that they're trying to do. I understand the rationale between the things that are adding in and trying to tie into the Lord of the Rings stuff. I can see where they're coming from and pretty much everything they put in. I think the problem is they're trying to mash two films together that really have no business colliding. The tone of The Hobbit as a book is very child-friendly. It has a few sort of darker moments, but for the most part, it is a child's novel with a few funny bits, and it's quite light-hearted. And the problem with trying to mash that into The Lord of the Rings is The Lord of the Rings is darker and weightier, and you can see the sort of change in tone this is when it tries to fit these two bits together, and it just doesn't work. When the bits that I've added in to this film with Gandalf fighting the necromancer, which turns out to no one's great surprise to be Sauron, the enemy of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the tone's all wrong, and it just doesn't quite sit properly as a film, and I think that's really the defining characteristic of what's not working in this franchise now. The rest of it's okay, you know, it's perfectly fine, and I enjoyed it well enough, and I think, as with the first one, for a film that is actually very long, pushing 3 hours, certainly you will be in there for 3 hours once you've sat through the trailers and the adverts, it doesn't really feel it. I thought it does manage to kind of captivate the attention well enough and keep bouncing along at such a pace that it doesn't feel its length. So in that respect, I have to say that I enjoyed enjoyed it. However, as with the first film, it is something that I am going to watch once and then probably never watch again. They are not the classics that Lord of the Rings are. They are simply quite entertaining movies that are quite fun to watch. Arguably, that's as much as you can expect from a film, but I think everyone had been looking for a lot more from this production team and this material, which is a bit of a shame, but I still enjoyed the film well enough. So what more can you ask for?
What more can you ask for indeed? Drew, did you ask for anything more?
I did. I didn't get it.
How did that make you feel?
Disappointed.
And how did that make you feel?
Disappointed.
I see. And how did that make you feel?
Disappointed.
A psychology lark's a mug's game. I can take quids in. Sorry, Drew.
I suspect I enjoyed this about as much as I enjoyed the first film, which was a reasonable amount, but not fantastically well.
Okay, and how did that make you feel? Sorry, Drew.
Though I did watch the first film on Netflix again a couple of weeks before seeing the sequel here, the second part, and enjoyed it quite a bit more. So whether that would happen with this one or not, I don't know. Again, as with the first film, it's the additions that bother me, because so much of it is padding. It doesn't just feel like padding, it's clearly padding, and it's easily the weakest stuff. And I'm a bit torn about the linking this with the Lord of the Rings, as Scott was talking about. I mean, I can see why they're doing it, but Scott's right, it doesn't work because it's a kid's book. I mean, some of it actually does make sense, as when Bilbo is fighting the spiders and he becomes very aggressive and very unlike him, and they're suggesting that's the influence of the ring, which it works in a way of making the ring more powerful. It's in the book. It's basically a wee novelty trinket that does some useful things, and you don't really find out what it is until the Lord of the Rings. But they're quite separate things, and they add in Gandalf fighting the necromancer, etc. But I feel that rather takes away from the character's mystique, because, you know, the idea of the wizard being quite a mysterious thing, and he just sods off for huge chunks of the book and then wanders back and nobody knows what he's done. And that's actually much more interesting. Where the hell's he gone now? And he just wanders back just when he needs to, and nobody knows what on earth he's doing. Let's say it's more interesting thing to do with the character.
Everyone assumes he's been out shagging.
Aye, mad shagger, aye, Gandalf. Yeah, so it's the addition stuff that bothers me. I mean, certainly there were some funny sequences in this. The whole Donkey Kong section is a hoot. And the other additions, again, instead of getting rid of the utterly extraneous orc character from the first one, they've doubled down on it and have two, and they're both terrible with abysmal dialogue. The phrase she-elf was particularly galling to me. It's just a terrible, terrible line. And the introduction of Orlando Bloom as Legolas again, and a female elf who falls in love with a dwarf. It just seems so unnecessary. I can see the appeal of putting a stronger female character in it, because there were basically no female characters in it. But it's just how they've done it seems unnecessary. It does feel less complete of a film in itself than the first film did. That it's clearly acting as a bridge, a bit like the problem we had with the Hunger Games Part 2.
You see, it is actually much worse for that. I didn't think the first installment did a particularly great job of giving you a reasonable conclusion to the film, and this one does an even worse job of it. That's really the weakest part of this film, is that they have no way to end these thirds that is remotely satisfying. And okay, well, I suppose the last one should have one, but that's easily the weakest part of it. It's the one area where they should have been putting more writing effort into, and it suffers drastically for not having it.
Yeah. They also seem determined to turn every single thing in this film into an action set piece, and it doesn't seem necessary. The whole sequence of Beorn in the book, it's kind of a humorous sequence when you have the hobbits just turn up in dribs and drabs to Beorn's door, and I'm getting sort of angry and exasperated, but slightly amused at the same time. And that would be a nice wee bit just to rest the film a little, add a wee bit of humour. But they turn that into an action set piece as well, and it changes it so much that it may as well not be in the film at all. It's so inconsequential. And it's more in this, well, Beorn's in the book, we better put this in here, but we'll change it. So some very odd choices there. Again, for some of us, I agree with Scott, I can understand the rationale, even if, unlike the Lord of the Rings films, the changes I don't agree with, I can understand why they're doing it, even if I think it's a bad decision. But it's just, again, I don't know, I repeat myself from the first film too, it suffers so much from padding. There's no reason for this to be three films. It should never have been three films. It should probably never have even been two, which was what I was originally being talked about. And it suffers for it because they just need to fill in lots of stuff that isn't really there.
Yeah, two with a bit of Lincoln, I could probably see. That would, I think, work a lot better than what's happened here. I would honestly far rather they just did a straight adaptation, more or less, of the source material, and I agree that would have been weird to do that without really tying it into the rest of the Lord of the Rings films, but I think it would have been better.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's been a huge misstep to assume that they have to tie it in with the Lord of the Rings films, to be honest with you. Or not assume, but that they've made the choice to do that, because, as you say, I think they're far too disparate a couple of entities to make the link convincingly.
When you read the books, when they exist in the same universe, but they really have so little in common with each other.
Mm.
And the other problem too, again, is I enjoyed this just not as much as I wanted to and I would like to. And if you liked the first one, I think you'd get something out of seeing this. But they also have the other problem too, of there doesn't seem to be an awful lot left to do in the last one. There's like most of the story's already been covered, so it just makes it feel like the entire last film's going to be a battle, which doesn't fill me with a lot of hope.
Mm. Did either of you see it in high frame rate?
No. Didn't see it in 3D either.
Nice.
I did see the first one in high frame rate, and I did like it. I did like the effect. However, not seen this one.
No, I haven't seen Desolation of Smaug. I did catch up with the first installment on Netflix, as you were saying, Drew, and I found it passable enough. Let's say for something pushing 3 hours running time, it did sort of nip along fairly well, but I had nothing of the initial reaction that I did to the Lord of the Rings films. Although, having said that, I think I've mentioned in a previous podcast that actually revisiting those now, I personally don't think the original Lord of the Rings trilogy is holding up all that well as films. But be that as it may, I feel like I've fallen foul of that trap already, where I'm like, I feel kind of compelled to see this one at some point because I gave in and watched the first already. So they've kind of already won because I know already I'm going to watch this and the third installment.
I see, that's the thing. I wouldn't like anybody to take it with the impression that it's not worth seeing. It's worth seeing. It's just, it could have been and should have been much more by being less.
Yeah, the first film was, you know, a lot better than quite a few films I saw last year. However, I don't think it's as masterful a piece of filmmaking as perhaps we thought The Lord of the Rings was at the time. It may not be academically, as it were, such a great film, but it's an entertaining film. And I can accept it on that in that context.
Yeah, if you're comparing it to sort of like big budget action-ish tentpole things, then it's, you know, easily holds its own amongst any of that lot. Mm. Just if you're comparing it with things that are considered classics of modern cinema, it can't make that.
Yeah. I mean, at 2¾ hours, I certainly got more money's worth out of The Hobbit than I did out of, say, 90 minutes of A Good Day to Die Hard. It's, you know, so it's not, like you say, it's not that the first installment wasn't entertaining, but yeah, no, I will catch up with it at some point. I'm not sure I want to spend £10 going to see it at the cinema, but I will catch up with it on
one of the things it does make me think is that, and it's other because of other Peter Jackson stuff, things that Peter Jackson is pretty adept at adapting stuff, because The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit is the strongest bits in both of the stuff, very, very based on the book or directly from it. Whereas as soon as he starts straying into inventing stuff himself, it's by far the weakest, and I've never really rated any of the rest of Jackson's output at all. So I don't know, maybe we should just stick to quite strict adaptations and stop trying to invent things.
I've enjoyed previous Jackson stuff, but I don't know, I'm actually incredibly ignorant on the topic. I mean, did he write most of the material for his previous films? Like,
he did indeed write Brain Dead, Meet the Feebles, Bad Taste, Heavenly Creatures, The Frighteners, etc. So he has written his own stuff in the past.
Mm.
And King Kong, and I don't really rate much of Jackson's other stuff, as I said. I've never really enjoyed them all that much.
I thought King Kong was pretty dire, to be honest.
Yeah, so I said that King Kong was terrible.
Mm.
Brain Dead, I don't like it, but kind of schlock film anyway. Meet the Feebles is atrocious.
I know people who swear by Meet the Feebles. I've never watched it, but I can't deny that I remember watching Bad Taste way back in the day on like Moviedrome or something when it came on TV over here, and to this day it remains a very, very funny film. But Brain Dead never really sat as well with me. I did really enjoy The Frighteners, I've got to say, or I recall enjoying The Frighteners, but
that's one I don't think I've seen.
Yeah, I found that entertaining enough. But just of late, I think his powder's gotten a bit damp. Well, I think we mentioned even possibly in the last podcast, did we not, we passed comment on at some point on The Lovely Bones and what a disappointment that was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe that's a fly in the ointment, because we were in the process of saying that actually he's much better at adapting material than he is at writing it, perhaps. But yeah, Lovely Bones, I wasn't all that much on board with, having read and thoroughly enjoyed the novel.
So I haven't read the novel, so I don't know whether that was it or not, but certainly there's no way to be certain, but that's my impression so far, is that he can do a good job of adapting stuff, but when he sort of strays into doing his own stuff, it's much weaker.
Yeah. Who does he think he is? Okay, in that case then, The Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug. Thumbs up or thumbs down then?
Oh, it's definitely thumbs up.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
always want it to be more.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that, because then we've just spent a good 5 minutes sort of being down on Peter Jackson in general. But
we wanted it to be better, could have been better, but it's still enjoyable. And again, if
coulda,
you like,
woulda, shoulda.
And if you liked the first film, then you're going to want to see this. You're going to want to see it to its conclusion. It's just, it's kind of disappointing in comparison to The Lord of the Rings, and it kind of misses the tone of the book a bit, which doesn't help.
Watch these, and then, do you know what, a year from now, or actually give it 18 months from now, there will be a 3-hour fan edit of all three films on YouTube or something like that. And that'll probably be the definitive version. Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues. Drew?
What can you say? It's about Anchorman, it continues. This takes place in the early 80s. The first film having been in the 70s. Ron Burgundy and his wife, Veronica Corningstone, have now moved to New York. And just when Ron thinks he's about to hit the big time, Harrison Ford, whose character's retiring, gives his job, his prime time anchor job, to Veronica and fires Ron, telling him he's the worst anchorman he's ever seen. He swiftly falls into a pit of despond and gets brought out of it when he's tapped up to host a show on, well, basically CNN, called GNN, I think, the first 24-hour news channel. Everybody thinks this is a barking mad idea, but it's a job. So he goes on a little road trip, gets the rest of the crew back together, old Brick and the other people who aren't Brick.
Brian Fantana and Champ Kind.
Thank you, Brian Fantana and Champ Kind, yeah. They go to New York to take part in their first broadcast, and they basically create Fox News. They're having the graveyard shift and thinking they can't possibly compete with the main news bulletin, the primetime show, and after having making a silly, possibly career-ending bet, they decide that what people don't want is the news they need. It's the news they want. So lots of animal stories, car chases, patriotism of the pretty odious flag-waving kind. But as I say, basically they create Fox News, and Ron Burgundy becomes an overnight sensation and changes news forever. There's not much to that. It's not the sort of film that really has a plot.
No, it really doesn't, does it?
It doesn't. But it's really quite funny. It certainly runs a bit long and gets very self-indulgent at parts. There's a whole subplot about Ron Burgundy losing his sight, which could have been cut entirely. In a nod to the original film, with the news gangs having fights with each other, there's a similar scene in this film. And it's quite funny, and there's a whole load of over-the-top celebrity cameos and things, but then it goes on, and it goes on a bit more, and it goes on a bit more, and it really is very self-indulgent. But beyond that, those are relatively minor niggles. I mean, it's not a brilliant film, but it's very funny, very entertaining. If you like the first one at all, you're going to get a lot out of this. It's not hugely coherent, but again, it doesn't really need to be, because it's just a load of gags loosely hung around the idea of Ron Burgundy being a news anchor. And it's fun. And it's funny. It's good.
Yeah, it does seem a recurring thing. A lot of reviews have seen that, oh, the plot's completely disjointed and it's nothing like the first one. The first one was also completely disjointed as well. It's just you happen to enjoy it a bit more.
It doesn't really have a plot as such. I mean, again, it's a loose framework on which to hang some gags.
It's very loosely linked vignettes.
Yeah, because the whole the plot, such as of the first one, is that Ron Burgundy's an anchorman and there's a woman comes in and he wants to bed her. And that's basically the only strong plot point of the first one. And the second one is Ron Burgundy loses his job and wants to get a new one.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was very funny. Like I said to you when I was coming to the cinema, I hadn't really realised that this was the original Anchorman was held in such high regard.
Oh, it's a very fondly thought of film, yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed it an awful lot. However, I kind of watched it once. I think I may have seen it once in an intervening, gosh, what is it, decade?
Yeah, it's about 10 years, I think, around about that.
And I enjoyed it, but I've not really thought about it an awful lot. So I suppose it was, if you hold the original in very high regard, then this will be setting yourself up for disappointment, because it's not as good as the first one. It just plainly isn't. It's not as funny. There's at least half an hour that should have been taken out. It's pushing 2 hours. I can't remember how long the first one is, but this definitely feels that it's outstaying its welcome. Yeah, at least the 20-minute stretch that just should not be there. However,
I think it does have the impression, this is going on a bit from what I said about being self-indulgent, it's like that they really liked the sequences that should have been cut out, so that's why they're in there. Maybe they could do with a bit of judicious editing.
Mm-hmm. However, it is funny. I think it does suffer a little bit from the... Well, perhaps unfair to say that it suffers, but there's been, I think, a clear decision, given that Steve Carell's become such a big star in the intervening 10 years, to give his character, Brick Tamland, a little bit more focus on it. And I think that they just about pulled that off, but it's not really the sort of character that deserves more screen time.
No, yeah, he is. He does have some of the funniest parts in it, but yeah, it's a one-note character. It's a stupid, emotionally crippled guy who shouts.
I think it's probably to Steve Carell's credit that it didn't fail. I thought for they kind of pulled it off, but I think by rights it really shouldn't have worked. I think they should have got really bored with that character, especially given they introduced a female Brick in the shape of Kirsten Wiig's character.
Kirsten Wiig stuff should have been dropped, absolutely. It's that was kind of painful, actually.
Yeah.
So, but then, just checking there, Scott, the first one was just over 90 minutes, so they've added basically an extra half hour of stuff into this one.
Yeah, it doesn't deserve to be there.
All of that half hour really.
However,
be dropped.
I mean, for saying all that, it did make me laugh probably as much as anything else that I've seen this year. I mean, it's not as expertly paced as perhaps some of the other things we might talk about in our Films of the Year podcast. However, it was very funny, and if you did enjoy the first one, I think even if you have to prepare yourself that it is not going to be as good as the first one. However, it's still pretty bloody good.
Also, the funniest funeral scene I've seen in quite some time.
Yes.
If ever, possibly. I was going to say it was strange, or maybe it's not, maybe it was deliberate, but the trailer I've seen quite a few times with them talking to the gay guy. Was that just produced for the trailer, do you think? Because it's not in the film, which surprised me.
Well, yes. I don't know why that's not in there, because it is actually one of the funnier bits, and they've certainly made no effort to sort of do that with any other bits, which I think were actually less funny than
exactly.
That.
There's half an hour of, again, compared to the first one, half an hour of extra stuff, almost all of which can be dropped, and the funny bit that's in the trailer isn't in the film.
Yeah.
It's very odd.
Most peculiar. But the rest of it's fine. So it does feature cameos by everyone, and for the most part, everyone does quite well in it.
Yes.
So there's that. Alan Partridge, one of those quintessentially British characters. I can't think where I was going with this intro, Scott. I'm not sure if it's so much that Alan Partridge is quintessentially English as much as the comedy of the Alan Partridge character has been with us for an awfully long time. From back in the day-to-day days. And Steve Coogan's character has been a mainstay of comic productions in this country for about 15 years, I suppose, quite some time.
It's not this day-to-day, not like 1984, so it's nearly 20.
Nearly 20 years. And despite having a fair few series, the character has been used for a fair few series, I don't think it's been overexposed. It's been done in a lot of small drabs as you've kind of followed along with Alan Partridge's shadow career, from hapless sports correspondent in the day-to-day to a mainstream television chat show audience to fading obscurity. And he now finds himself back in Norfolk as a DJ for Norfolk Digital Radio. This film follows on from the Sky production of Mid-Morning Matters, which I've not actually seen, and sees Steve Coogan's Alan Partridge continuing along. He's in the office along with Cole Meaney's Pat Farrell as the Norfolk Digital station is taken over by a crowd of new executives who want to tart up the station's reputation and start appealing to a younger audience, which means a culling of some of the older members of the Norfolk Digital herd. It's either going to be Alan Partridge or Pat Farrell, and thanks to Alan Partridge's amazing pleading for his own job, he stays. Call me Nice, Pat Farrell goes.
not so much pleading for his own job as a spectacular pitch for sacking Pat, really, is it?
Just sack Pat.
Yes. Yes. Perhaps more accurate to say, throwing Pat Farrell under a bus. Alan Partridge retains his own job. However, this is not the end of the story, as Pat Farrell is somewhat upset by this turn of events and shows back up at the launch party for the new station, wielding a shotgun and setting to motion a hostage situation and a siege, which sees Alan Partridge running as the go-between between the police officers and Pat Farrell. Now, there's not really a great deal more to it than that. It is just a useful setup to get a number of quite extreme situations for Steve Coogan's character to be in, which when you first heard that this is how they were going to go for this film, I don't think there was anyone who thought, well, that sounds like a good idea, because it sounded like a terrible idea. So I'm quite surprised that it's worked as well as it has. There is the usual contingent of UK comedians that make up the rest of the cast. However, it's in the main Steve Coogan in Colm Meaney's film, and Colm Meaney does remarkably well as Pat Varrell, which is a character which shouldn't really work. And the interactions with him and Alan Partridge, as they basically continue on doing a 24-hour round-the-clock broadcast with the same obsequious banter as you normally find in these sort of things, works far better than it has any right to. And that's really the succinct summation of the entire film. It just works far better than it has any right to. I found it amazingly funny that it has the same intricacies of the language that is used. The most obvious one, I suppose, is the one that's been in the trailers, where in discussions it is claimed that Alan Partridge is going to be the face of this siege, to which Steve Coogan, of course, responds, "I am Siege Face." And there's a few other little perversions of the English language in this that I find amazingly funny, and that alone would have made it quite amusing for me, but there's a number of great comic touches throughout. Lots of even just little moments, as you expect, with sort of something of, I've not actually checked if Armando Iannucci is involved with this, but I assume that he is.
Yeah, I believe he is.
Some credit in there. Little things like the siege, of course, eventually attracts some support from the local community. So there's a group of protesters outside the station, one of whom's carrying a placard saying, "Pat Farrell, the Fat Barrel." And I don't know why I found that so funny. Which is an unusual statement of support for the character. Between that and some other, just other little tiny touches. I mean, the broad stroke of the film, arguably not that funny. However, there's just all these little moments throughout that I thought really highlighted it, and there's just moments of absolute genius in there that get me laughing throughout. And on that basis, I found it's as funny a film as I've seen this year. I'm not a massive Alan Partridge fan, to be honest with you, but I think this is easily the funniest thing I've seen it in. And curiously enough, just as Steve Coogan's finally stepping out of the shadow of Alan Partridge with some really great roles this year. And actually coming across as someone who's not just Alan Partridge.
In a sense,
this is easily the best Alan Partridge. It's quintessential Alan.
If his aim this year were to break away, he's kind of accidentally potted the white on this.
Yeah, the crazy thing is, I mean, good as his performance in a straight role in Philomena was, that was excellent. He's just brilliant in this. It's a superb.
Yeah, we love him as a comedian, role, don't we?
See, the thing about Alan Partridge is, barely seen it since the days of the day-to-day. And I rather suspect I never really got Alan Partridge before, because I was pissing myself laughing throughout this. I absolutely loved it. And it's got to say, some of the, just the use of the words and talking about a Grexodus cracked me up. And then
that's classic Partridge.
Yeah. And there's a scene too where they're listening to a transcript and they won't stop talking about Banged Up Abroad, and I'm dying.
Just skip to the bit where they stop saying Banged Up Abroad.
There's not much more to say to what Scott said, other than that even if you don't like Alan Partridge, and I never did, and again, I suspect I didn't get it, but I loved this film. I thought it was hilarious, and I'd never liked the character much before, so if that's any recommendation, then you may want to check this out. Yeah, it's a hoot.
I rather wonder how well it'll travel abroad, but certainly in the UK, there's the highest recommendation.
Yeah, I'm coming at this from a slightly different angle, in that sort of gradually over the years I've sort of assimilated the Partridge and become like more of a fan, and kind of enjoyed all of the Partridge output, to be honest with you, up to and including the novel I, Partridge, which the autobiography, if you will, which was released, sorry, I have to think, not last year, but 2012. I have to stop and think what last year actually was as a concept. I really enjoyed
it. Best subtitle for a fake autobiography ever, as well, that we need to talk about Alan.
And I'm really, and honestly, even that, which I was expecting to be like a cheap cash in, I actually found to be genuinely, genuinely funny. And so I sat down to Alpha Papa with high expectations when I watched it on catch up via the iTunes store the other day on Apple TV. And I actually came away from it slightly disappointed. And I want to go back to it, because I'm hoping that it's going to be one of those "I was just in a wrong mood that day" kind of deals, because I felt this is the kind of film that probably should have played better on a sofa than it possibly did in the cinema. Although what I will say for in terms of TV properties making the transition to film, Alan Partridge sort of sidesteps that classic pitfall that has always caused British TV programmes to come a cropper in the upgrade to the big screen, in that it hasn't tried to go for some overblown plotline, really. It hasn't done the whole let's get on a bus and go on holiday thing or anything like that. It's just taken the essence of what Alan Partridge is and moved essentially what could have been a one-off TV special onto the big screen. It's not essentially tried to do anything inherently cinematic or anything that takes massive advantage of that medium. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, it's been far more successful than any number of properties which have fallen foul of that and just failed to deliver. So I'll grant it that, but I'm really going to have to go back and watch it again because I only got two belly laughs, I think, out of the whole film. Like a couple of snickers here and there, but one or two belly laughs. I really was expecting more than that. So I'm gonna put it down to my just not being in the right mood. I'm going to do it. And when we do our next podcast, I'm going to come back to you listeners and tell you my reassessment of it, because I was deeply disheartened by the end of it. And I don't want to feel that way about this film. I'm going to put my faith in the notion that I am wrong in this, because everybody else, including, you know, everyone else I know whose opinions I trust, and including people who aren't necessarily particularly big Partridge fans to begin with, found it really more enjoyable than I did. So, hey-ho, there you go. Still, having said that, it was still a lot... Even taking into account the fact I may have been in completely the wrong mood, it still proved funnier than any number of films that I've watched this year that were trying to pass themselves off as comedies.
Yes.
And absolutely were not. So on that basis, it still gets a pass. But I'm hoping that I'll watch it again and enjoy it more second time round. So I guess watch this space. Which leaves us with the documentary Blackfish. Drew, tell us what we can expect from Blackfish.
Ostensibly, this is about Tilikum, a killer whale who has killed three humans while in captivity. But Gabriella Cowperthwaite's documentary is really an exploration of the conditions that these powerful and intelligent creatures are kept in places like SeaWorld, that's the most famous example, and the commercial pressures that drive it. It features archive footage, testimony from wildlife experts, trappers, former trainers and employees from the water parks where Tilikum has been kept. And Blackfish paints a pretty horrendous picture of the life of a captive orca that is likely to generate significant levels of indignant rage in viewers. Now, as with many documentaries, it's pretty one-sided. I mean, there's only one naysayer of any note featured, and there's no representative from SeaWorld to put their point of view, but it's still a worthy piece and may open your eyes to the treatment these magnificent creatures are subjected to in order to provide us with entertainment. And just as an addendum to what I said about it being one-sided, it may be one-sided, but when you find out that they're keeping this massive, powerful creature that weighs like 6-7 tons and normally has the entire ocean to roam in inside a big hut effectively for 20 hours a day, and then they catch them by throwing bombs at families of whales, it's hard to see what other side there could be put to this.
In a sense, I understand why your summation is so short, because essentially there isn't a lot more to it than that. And I think 2013 was, I would say, probably a particularly strong year for documentary filmmaking. I don't know if you guys would agree or not, but we seem to be on this upward curve of documentaries gathering some sort of pace. And it's a filmic medium which is, it's grabbed the popular conscience a little more than perhaps it had in previous years. So we've seen films, you know, 2012 was kind of the year of the sport documentary with TT and Senna garnering a lot of praise. And this year we've seen things like Jiro Dreams of Sushi, or sorry, last year, 2013, we saw things like Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Indie Game.
Yeah, Indie Game, the movie, which sort of started to look at a diverse range of topics. And it's great that documentary filmmaking has sort of regained that sort of foothold and is more of, well, let's be honest, a commercially viable proposition, because filmmaking so often comes down to what's commercially viable. But whereas films like Indie Game and Jiro Dreams of Sushi dealt with quite specific topics which were of interest, I guess they weren't necessarily topics of core importance or massive moral importance, put it that way. And I think the reason why Blackfish succeeds so well, although obviously, as you say, Drew, it kind of is a very one-sided story. It's hard to see what the other side of that story would legitimately be.
That's
to grant
so much
extra screen time.
that's so much of a point. It's like, you think that you'd want somebody from SeaWorld to be there giving their point of view, but it's like, okay, justify catching baby whales with bombs and keeping them in big sheds, please. I'm not sure how you'd justify that.
And this is how it succeeds. It is, in and of itself, quite an accomplished documentary. And although the agenda, if it can be said to have one, which I think we can agree, it probably has.
And a successful one too, given the results it's had on SeaWorld, particularly their recent Christmas concerts thing.
Yeah,
where
absolutely.
Did they even go ahead in the end? All bar one, last I'd heard of the acts, had pulled out of it.
Where it kind of wears that agenda on its sleeve, typically for a documentary, that can be quite a detrimental thing, because usually the object of the game is to give a balanced viewpoint, while at the same time, hopefully, you know, the viewer taking away a definite stance. In this case, it's one of those sort of, not necessarily an elephant in the room, but I think anyone who watches this documentary probably won't have to do a lot of soul searching to agree that actually this thing that a great number of us, myself included, have partaken in.
Pretty horrendous.
Yeah, I paid money to go to SeaWorld, and it makes you think about where our entertainment's coming from and at what price. And really, when it comes to animal, I found watching it really, really difficult. I have a great deal more empathy for animals than I generally do for human beings, and we put ourselves in this position of being such caretakers for so many species of animal when we build attractions around them and when we build zoos and things. And actually, when you watch this film and you come to understand the circumstance, which, do you know what? A great deal of it is actually under your nose if you care to pay attention to it. When you pay your 30 quid for a ticket or whatever the going rate is these days at SeaWorld, and you pay to see a killer whale or a dolphin jumping out of a pool and, you know, hit a balloon with its nose, then, you know, and applaud the minute that dolphin lands back in the water and swims back through its gate to its holding pen, your attention to that is drawn to the next act coming up, and you casually stick to one side of your head what it is that happens to that animal thereafter and the conditions that they have to endure. It's hard necessarily to justify saying that this documentary so much has an agenda, as it does just kind of lay the facts under your nose, and all of those facts to the point that really the facilities built around these animals and the very notion of their purpose and the way in which these animals are removed from their environment, not for conservation but for entertainment, is actually absolutely reprehensible, and there is no argument against that.
Exactly, yes.
And it was an incredibly difficult watch, and on more than one occasion watching this documentary, I found myself getting incredibly upset, and I think that speaks volumes about its potency, not necessarily as an argument for or against one thing, but just in highlighting that really this is an avenue we've gone down as a species ourselves in the name of entertainment, which is just incredibly obviously wrong, and we need to put the brakes on and do a U-turn pretty quickly if we want to be able to look ourselves in the mirror each morning. Maybe I'm being overly dramatic there, but there you go. That's the sort of feeling that it evoked in me.
I'd say that's largely how I felt. I mean, I felt quite a huge surge of fury during most of it. But again, I mean, I mentioned it a couple of times, but you see there's a interview with a trapper who...
The guy who was a Vietnam War vet.
Yeah, but he said he was involved in coups in South America and stuff and never saw anything as brutal as catching the orca family by throwing bombs at them. They threw bombs at these whales to herd them into places and then stole all the children, basically.
Yeah. And the fact that SeaWorld would actually film that happening as well seems, well, it paints them to be somewhat stupid, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think that's reckless, but also kind of callous too.
Callous, and ultimately that footage of the, at some point during that footage, there's a shot of the female orca with her head out of the water making the most horrible wailing noise, trying to contact her children, and it's absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about it. For me, it succeeds in delivering an incredibly potent message, and I kind of feel like, although if I knew how upset I was going to be watching it, you know, in retrospect, it might actually have put me off in one sense, but I'm glad I did watch it, and it's one of those films that I think sort of transcends its topic essentially and becomes something that really should be required watching for anybody who's ever thought about exchanging money for entertainment from animals.
Yeah, I think it's quite telling too, the channel it was broadcasting, the reason all that stuff happened with the Christmas concerts at SeaWorld was that it was shown on US television just before Christmas. And what it was shown, I mean, let's just put aside for a moment just quite how much news US news channels actually carry, but it was on CNN. Right, that's the channel that showed it, I'm sure. Like, it wasn't even like Discovery Channel or something. It's a bit like more mainstream than that. It's like almost that it's more worthy that it's on CNN, and it's really, it's worthwhile being something like that because it is important. It's, you know, we share this planet with all these creatures, and it's different if you're eating stuff because humans have to survive, and maybe some meat's not sustainable. But no, this isn't about human survival. It's like, I look at these fishies swimming about.
The mistake we make is that we assume we are the only species which has any interest in its own preservation above sort of being instinctual, and that we are the only ones with agency and intelligence. And really, that does nothing more than highlight our own ignorance about the environment around us, because up until even sort of 20 or even 10 years ago, really we understood very little about these animals. And before we'd taken the time to understand them, we'd decided to put them in pens and make them jump through hoops to give us a laugh. Whereas really now all the evidence we have points to the fact that these are incredibly intelligent, self-aware, communal, familial animals who feel grief every bit as much as we do. And if someone came into your home and started throwing bombs to distract you and then grabbed your child and took them away and you never got to see them again, how would you feel about that? Because that, as dramatic as it sounds, that's exactly the position we've put these animals in for the sake of entertainment and for building multi-million pound entertainment industries around them and for whose benefit. It's not so much a documentary for me as it is just required viewing, to be honest. And I almost feel like discussing the merits of it as a piece of filmmaker are almost incidental.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair point.
Yeah. But Scott, did you watch Blackfish?
Yeah, but I don't really care about whales.
Oh, cool.
There was a few moments in this which is really less of a documentary than it is an op-ed piece that was really tripping my bullshit sensor. And that kind of put me on guard for the rest of it. I mean, that's what we were talking about to a neurologist who says whales have an entire separate bit of their brain that deals with emotion that we don't have. Really? You sure about that? Because we don't really know an awful lot about our brains. And to claim such knowledge of whales seemed like bullshit to me, especially when the same character showed up about half an hour later saying, "We think that whales' sense of self-identity is distributed throughout their pod," which sounded like total bullshit to me. That kind of put me on guard, and I was sort of taking the rest of it with a bit of a grain of salt, to be honest with you, after that. The treatment of the whales was regrettable. I think I was probably more upset with the SeaWorld's deliberate obfuscation and corporate policies of lying to the public and their trailers.
The trainers. The public was pretty egregious.
And that seemed particularly indefensible. However, again, we should note that there is no defence made in this. It is essentially entirely one-sided. There is possibly some case that should be answered from SeaWorld's side of things, and it's not. I believe they would have been given a response opportunity to, but they chose not to take it. And to be honest, I wouldn't blame them. I don't think they would get fair treatment in that. However, it's hard to see exactly what that treatment would be.
Exactly.
However,
yeah.
we have as a species decided that it is fair game to capture all animals for our entertainment. And until that changes, this is a fulcrum to which to lever that effect. But of course, we would now have to close down all water parks and all zoos and renounce that completely. And will that happen?
I don't think necessarily there's an argument for closing zoos, but certainly I'd have...
Well, I think anyone who's seen a caged lion pace from one side to the other will see that there's... At what point do you draw the line of saying, well, it would be cruel to imprison a whale or a dolphin or...
But not
a lion.
But not
an antelope, they're fine.
I think I've always felt torn about the notion of zoos, because essentially at its core a zoo should be about animal conservation.
They didn't used to be, but they are very much now. Well, most Western zoos anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a very grey area. And to be honest with you, like I probably, despite living on the doorstep of one of the UK's best, if not best zoos, you know, for given values of best, depending on which way you fall in this argument, it's difficult for me to know what to feel one way or the other about it, because I like to believe that at heart, that's the core of the principle of them nowadays, as Drew points out. Obviously, it wasn't the case to begin with. But I don't think there's any argument whatsoever for maintaining, you know, places like SeaWorld. I would see them close their doors tomorrow. But at the same time, I absolutely understand and take on board the points you're making there. I still don't think it necessarily takes away from the core message or my feelings about it. But as I say, as someone who has a great deal of empathy for animals anyway, I think probably, yeah, I'm absolutely predisposed to taking on board that stuff and probably actually didn't consider enough the points that you've just raised. But I don't think, taking that into account, I don't think it would change my opinion. But what about, so as a piece of, if we stick to our self-imposed remit of judging stuff on the merits of how good a piece of filmmaking it is, Drew, what do you think of Blackfish?
I think it's very difficult to separate the two in this instance.
Yeah, because as I said earlier, it is one-sided, but again, you don't know what reasonable response you could have to the other side.
I asked because Scott made a number of cogent points there that actually, if you think about them, point to the fact that as a piece of objective filmmaking, this probably
it's not objective at all.
But, no, as a piece of technical filmmaking, it's probably incredibly
that's
flawed.
Why I describe it as an op-ed. Yeah. Because if you were to look at this as a documentary, then it's not. Mm. But to be honest, almost every documentary that you will see is not really a documentary, in as much as if it was a documentary, it would just be telling you certain facts. Whereas obviously everything's been made to fit the narrative they want to
supply. Yeah, Gino Dreams of Sushi or Indie Game the Movie were documentaries, whereas this obviously has more of an agenda as opposed to just outlining.
It's a polemic. That's the thing. Hmm. It isn't an informative documentary in that sense. It's a polemic. But again, they've got a pretty reasonable stand and issue to take into this film here. It's hard to sort of discuss technically. I don't think you can.
There's no denying that it's a powerful film, regardless of whether we want to haggle about whether it's properly a documentary or whatnot. Yeah. It's clearly very powerfully emotional. And if you've any interest whatsoever in animal preservation, or even if you don't, in fact, particularly if you don't, that's why you should watch the film.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that I'm far too open to sort of emotional influence like that, especially on a topic where I've already got an opinion one way or another. But I think it's interesting that it can raise that kind of discussion. But yeah, and if any good comes of it, if it raises that discussion in public and brings it into a public forum and people start to talk more about the issues that it raises, that it itself is obviously, as we pointed out, quite one-sided about. If we can get that debate going in a public arena and come to some sort of conclusion about it and make some progress therein, then I suppose it's achieved something, and in that sense, it has its merits. Yes, so there you go. That was another oneliner.com podcast. We will hopefully see you again. What kind of technology is this? You will hopefully hear from us again sooner rather than later with our roundup of 2013 and our favourite films thereof. But until such a time, I was Craig, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was unequivocably Drew.
Farewell.
See you later. Bye.
He gets involved in a gang war between Demis Roussos and Roy Hudd.
No, that's not accurate.
Why the fascination with Demis Roussos?
Because I had no idea who he was before tonight, and now I'm his biggest fan.